It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Royal London, who, as proud sponsors of One Day Cricket, are also the UK's largest mutual life pensions and investment company, providing financial services to millions of people across the country. To find out more, visit www.royallondon.com. Hello, I'm Simon Hughes. This is the Analyst Inside Cricket, and it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday, which in 3 days' time will be about the start of the first ever day-night test match in England. England playing for the West Indies, of course, in Edgbaston, starting around about 2 o'clock and finishing at 9:30. Be intriguing to find out what happens, and we're going to look ahead to that game.
We're also going to look more specifically at the pink ball. I'm Simon Mann, and you have been speaking to the person who owns Duke Balls, and you've got a chance to win one later in this podcast as well.
That's right. And it's been very interesting to see the development of the pink ball and how it's actually evolved over, you know, the last sort of 2 or 3 years of experiments and so on. So, as you say, we're going to talk about that a bit later. We should certainly first look at the changes England have made, the team going into this test, and maybe, you know, the prospects for the West Indies as well. I know you were away last week. What did you deduce from England's performance at Old Trafford in that last test? You came back saying it was the same test all over again.
Well, it was. We've had the four test matches that have all been the same this summer. They followed exactly the same pattern. I thought we sort of might have broken it at the Oval. You know, we've had three games. Old Trafford's going to be different. But no, it's exactly the same test match, yeah. Isn't it?
Each test was won by the team batting first, who won the toss.
And got a decent lead in the first innings and then made the most of it.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, obviously last week's podcast, we talked a little bit to Stuart Broad about batting collapses. And there does seem to be this sort of lack of attention, lack of aptitude to really battle back from difficult situations. 22 collapses by England in the last 39 tests, and plenty from the opposition as well. It's almost as if people just can't be bothered to, once they see the writing on the wall of a game, they almost think, well, that game's gone, let's think about the next one.
Of course, you've got to get runs on the board in the first place, and that's what all four teams batting first did in that South Africa series. So what it means is that England made changes again because there's been fallibility at the top of the order. This time, it's Jennings out and Stoneman in. It's been the summer for old men, or the summer for older, younger men, if you see what I mean, isn't it, really? With, you know, we've had players of 28, 29, four players of 28, 29 making their debuts this summer. Well, a 30-year-old now. We're actually going higher with Mark Stoneman coming in. What do you think about that? I mean, was it inevitable that Stoneman got his chance eventually? He's been touted all summer. And Alex Stewart told us earlier in the summer that, you know, he was told right at the start, that before the Lords game, that he would have been in a 13 for Lords, and he wasn't in that 13 because they picked a 12, and of course he didn't get a game there. But finally, he's got his chance. He's missed the South Africans. He's got the West Indians,
which is good and bad. You know, obviously playing against the West Indies, actually I think they'll be a bit better with the ball than people are imagining. I don't think their batting is all that good, but I think we've got one or two bowlers that are decent. We can talk about a bit later. He's got the West Indies, but he's also got the pink ball to deal with in the day-night game. So it's.
But he'll get more than one game, won't he? So yeah. Even if he has a bad game against the pink ball, he'll get he'll probably get all the series, actually.
I think that 29-30 is a good age, actually, to come into the England side. People are much fitter now at 30 than they probably were 20 years ago. And also, they know their game. And I think it makes a lot of sense to... someone like Tom Wesley, who's played 6 or 7 years of Championship cricket, in Stoneman's case, 10 years of Championship cricket, can you really get to know your game as a batsman? I think that cricket is a game for older batsmen and younger bowlers. I mean, bowling is so hard physically that you need to be 25 to do it really, really well. Jimmy Anderson is unique to be able to still do what he's doing at 35. But batsmen... takes a long time to get through the troubles about technique and the mental approach and being comfortable with your own method and knowing how to make a bowler bowl where you want him to bowl, for instance. And so I like players coming in at that age. I mean, Joe Root, Alistair Cook were sort of old men before they were old. They were so good. They had the game by the throat at 22, and that's really rare. And most players take seven, 8 years of Championship cricket to really nail down a batting job.
I'm not totally convinced by that argument, personally. Okay. I'm just not convinced. I think that you should be able to show something really significant by the age of 25. You really need to be in that England team by the age of 25. Okay, you might go in, fail, and then come out again. I just wonder. I think we're getting to a stage where the selectors are, sort of scouting around for players. They go, well, that failed. He's been exposed. He's been on all the television cameras, all the media exposure. Clearly, he's got a technical deficiency. We're going to have to take him out of the team. We have to bring someone else in. Obviously, he's got a field 11. And basically, they're just dropping down the list. I mean, I'm hoping that Mark Stoneman actually does succeed. I mean, he's looked a good player for a few years. I mean, yeah. He's played up at Durham where the pitches do offer something for the bowlers, open the batting there. You always like to get a decent one early on. His first-class average is 34, but whenever I've seen him, he's looked a good player. Paul Collingwood, we've talked about this before, said 3 years ago he should be playing. So perhaps that's when he should have been playing, actually, at the age of 27, when there was a vacancy, because England have tried so many openers over the last 2 or 3 years.
I mean, now, this season, having gone to the Oval predominantly, he's averaging 59, and maybe that is a combination of coming down south and playing on slightly better wickets and maybe, really being comfortable with his game. I think he looks like he's got a good game. Just looking at the way he bats, he's got the shots that he knows he can play. I felt with someone like Keaton Jennings, he was still sort of trying to find his way a bit, even though he got 100 in that test match in India. I felt he was searching for what is his game, whereas I think Stoneman knows it. He knows he's good on the pull shot. He can drive crisply. He's quite a compact sort of player, but he's quite busy. He's quite aggressive, but he can also bat a long time. And that's a good combination to have. So I'm really hopeful that he's the one. But I like your point about the way that tried to find a player who's 27, 28 and going down through the card almost. And that if you haven't shown true class by the age of 28, will you ever? I mean, that's also a good point.
I think that is basically my point. You want to see it by the age of 24, 25. Anyway, Mark Stoneman might buck that trend and have a decent, 5 or 6 year test match career. Like Mike Hussey did that, for example, didn't he? I think he made his debut for Australia at the age of 30. I mean, the difference there, of course, was there were so many other good players he was trying to force out of the team, and then eventually a place became available. This is a bit of a different situation where England have got 7 or 8 very good cricketers in their team, but they haven't got a team. They haven't got an 11 that is rock solid. And with the Ashes coming up, there are still lots of question marks, it seems to me.
There are. And the one thing you don't want to do going out to Australia is being not sure what your batting top six is. So let's hope, for England's sake, that Stoneman can find a way to make enough runs to be convincing. And he's I think he's Alistair Cook's 14th opening partner, isn't he? It's incredible, the sequence. But I've got a feeling that Stoneman might be the right guy, actually.
Okay. What about the two others that have been brought in very briefly? I mean, Wesley has done okay. Milan hasn't got a run yet.
No, and I think the test match environment has surprised David Milan a little bit. And when I say Test match environment, I just mean the intensity of the game, the crowd attention, the microscopic analysis, everything that goes with playing for England in a Test match is quite a big step up. And he's just found it bigger than he was perhaps expecting. I think he's still got the talent, and provided he's got the understanding, and provided he, I think he's someone who's a little bit of a tinkerer with his method, and every day he has a little thing he's working on. And I don't think you can afford to do that in a Test match against good bowling attacks, because they'll find you out very quickly. You don't want to be still thinking, am I taking my bat back straight? Is my grip right? Is my trigger movement good? You want to be just thinking, right, play the ball. Play the ball, play the situation, forget about technique. And at the moment, he's a bit too conscious of his technique. Tom Wesley, I think he looks all right. He's got an obvious weakness. Most batsmen have a weakness of some kind. His is a little bit intent on chasing a ball outside off stump, which isn't quite full enough, and playing with too much right hand and shoulder, so he doesn't really hit down the ground. He tends to sort of hit it a bit too much through mid-on. It's a strength and a weakness. He's very powerful through the leg side. He just needs to work on his offside game. But he's a good timer of the ball, and I thought his temperament was excellent. He looked comfortable in that environment. I would stick with him for a bit. Obviously, both of them need a bit more time. But I think of the two, Wesley has the better temperament. Maybe Milan has more real skill.
Wokes is back in the squad as well. Does he come straight back in? I mean, it wasn't that long ago. He was almost the first name on the team sheet, or he forced himself to be the first name on the team sheet, or first, you know, second, third name on the team sheet. He's done so well.
Wokes is a great cricketer to have in the England side, and they obviously missed him. I think it gives them so much stability because of the bowling, because of the sort of the regularity of the bowling, the reliability, really, and obviously a very good number eight. I always worry a bit with bowlers when they come back, having not done that much bowling.
He bowled 20 overs in that championship match against Middlesex. He played a couple of second-team games. I don't think he bowled in one of them. So he hasn't bowled a huge amount.
And it's all very well to say, well, you've done all the training, you've done all the rehab and everything, and I know he has very well. But when you get into a big game, a Test match or whatever, you know, there's you're keyed up. You know, and everything just happens a bit quicker, and you just try that bit harder, and that's when things break if they're not quite right. And what often happens, of course, with injuries is you build up the suspect area massively, and then you favour the other leg or another part of your body because you had this injury, and then something else goes. And so it's a very, you just need to play a fair bit. So I would treat him with cotton wool a bit, and I wouldn't necessarily play him this test, actually. I think, you know, he'd be bowling when it's quite cool at night, when that's when injuries can happen. I think I'd just get him even more cricket, so even if it's just practice, in the middle, lots of hard stints of bowling in practice, and have him maybe for the last couple of tests or something. And there's three tests quite close together. I'm not sure, although it's tempting to bring him back at Edgbaston's home ground, I wouldn't actually.
Okay, right. It's obviously a big day on Thursday, the first ever day-night Test match to be played in this country. They've been doing it in Australia for a couple of years now, and there was one out in Dubai as well. Is this the start of a sort of a Test match revolution? Is it sort of the next stage? And we've had change, of course. We've had the DRS system brought in. Now we've got day-night Test match cricket that seems to be growing as well. England are going to play two more, aren't they, this winter? One in Adelaide, and then one in New Zealand at Eden Park. Do you see this sort of the next step, if you like, to a sort of Test match revolution, the way it's played, i.e. four-day Test match cricket, 96 overs per day, under lights, nearly all games being played under lights?
Definitely not all games played under lights. I can see more games played under lights overseas, certainly in places like New Zealand where they've struggled for crowds, places like the West Indies where obviously playing at night is very sensible, and Australia, the odd one. I don't think it works in England personally. I know there's been good crowd response to this Edgbaston day-night game. The ticket sales are good. 50% of the people who bought tickets haven't been to a Test match before. That's great. But I don't think it really works in England. People are sitting around at 10 o'clock at night watching, or 9 o'clock at night watching. The slow evolution of a Test match is very different from at 9 o'clock at night with music blaring and people jumping up and down with their four slogans and banners and things in a one-day game. I think one-day cricket under lights here is great. I don't think Test cricket is quite right for England, but it's worth a try just to create a bit of noise.
What you're going to have, though, if you do have a situation where lots of day-night Test matches are played abroad, the majority of them, and they're not in England, you're going to have a sort of a two-tier system where England play with a red ball at home and in the day and then have to go and play day-night Test cricket abroad. Very unfamiliar. I mean, conditions are unfamiliar enough abroad as it is in Test match cricket. And then the other teams are going to have to come back here having played pink ball day-night Test cricket and play day cricket with a red ball. You know, sort of two parts of the game.
I don't think that matters. If we can make sure that Test cricket survives around the world using whatever tactics that we need, that's fine. It doesn't matter if you're playing with a different coloured ball at night. I mean, they do that in one-day cricket now, don't they? They play one-day day cricket and they play one-day day-night cricket in the same series. It might be a different coloured ball abroad sometimes. I don't think it really matters that much. I think they've worked on the pink ball enough now that they're used to playing the white ball against the red ball sort of a few days apart. So what's the difference with playing a pink ball and a red ball a few days apart, really? I think that the main thing is to try and get more people into the ground to watch Test cricket abroad at a time when they can come, which is obviously at night, and the climate is nice to play cricket at night in places like Australia and West Indies and so on. Regarding your other question, four-day games, four-day tests, I think that makes a lot of sense because, for a start, the average test duration over the last 30 years is 320 overs. And I know that you're going to say in India, places like that, test matches last longer than 320 overs. They do. But an average over the world of test match duration is about 320 overs, which is 80 overs a day, four-day cricket. So if you had 90 overs a day or 96 overs a day, that's plenty of time to get a result. And I think the big thing about four-day tests is that you start on a Thursday, you end on a Sunday, you've got two corporate days, Thursday, Friday, which are good days for people to take time out of the office in England or abroad because it's the end of the week. And then you sell, obviously, Saturday and Sunday big time to the public. Monday has always been a dead loss and it's really, really tough to sell. I know that the chief executive of Old Trafford, for instance, was very happy that the Dame didn't go to a fifth day because you had to pay stewarding, catering, etc., a lot of money for a small crowd, small income, and quite often you've got to hand the money back to the punters if there's only 20 overs play. So the fifth day's a difficult one to sell. Plus, if you have Thursday to Sunday, you've then got 3 days off, then you can play another game Thursday to Sunday. It just makes it much more consistent and more understandable.
Well, change is happening. Pink ball, day-night test cricket. Do you think four-day cricket is close?
We take a long time to make these decisions and it probably isn't that close. But I think within 5 years, I think we'll have test matches over 4 days. Obviously, we've got to make more overs in a day to give people their money's worth. And we've got to be stricter on the over rates to make sure that teams actually maintain them. But now with floodlights and with the option to start a bit earlier if the overs haven't been bowled and making up time for bad light or obviously rain, I think it's feasible, four-day tests. And I'd hope in the next 4 or 5 years it happens.
OK. Well, after the break, we're going to talk more about the pink ball, your chance to win one as well. And you're going to hear from the man whose job it is to make them. He wants a new era of cricket where the bowlers fight back. Welcome back. Let's talk more about the pink ball now. It's right at the heart, of course, of what's going to happen in the next few days of the day-night test match. If you don't get the ball right, then it ruins the game. Also, your chance to win a brand new one in just a moment. Simon, is this ball workable? Is it a work in progress or are we there? Have we got a good enough ball for proper test match cricket?
Well, I've got one in my hand and I definitely think this is a very workable ball for test cricket. It looks exactly like the red Duke's ball, except that it's pink. Everything else about it, feel, polish.
Well, it's got a black seam as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a black seam, but you know, colour-wise, obviously it's different. But in every other way, it's been worked on and worked on and worked on to such an extent that I think it's as good as it can possibly get now. They've tried different dyes in it. They've tried different resins on the top to keep the dye, keep the pink colour. They've tried, as you say, different coloured seams, and the black seam seems to stand out better for batsmen. And I think all in all now, it's a very, very good product. And I think it will guarantee an interesting game on Thursday. I think that if you look at the stats of the round of day-night county championship matches, which played at the end of June, that there wasn't much difference in the behaviour of the ball compared to a red one. If you look at the number of wickets that fell and the runs that were scored, over a round of championship games the previous 2 weeks, a wicket had fallen every 32 runs, and in the day-night round, a wicket fell every 30 or 31 runs, round about 31, say. So it was about a run less per wicket, but that's not a lot. And there were times when teams, when it was coming to the twilight hour, tried to get through their overs quicker with the spinners so that the new ball was available, or the second new ball was available, around the twilight time. So they sort of focused on when the new ball and the faster bowlers would bowl to try and exploit what they're calling the twilight zone. Mm. So that could have influenced the way that the wickets fell slightly more regularly, but it was only slight. And the only other thing that the players have mentioned really is that the ball seems to make a slightly different sound off the bat. Nobody really cares about that, as long as it goes off the bat when you middle it. And I think that might be due to the fact that it's got this sort of slight plastic coating on it compared to the Duke's red ball, which is just basically leather. And it's the same, the pink ball, as the white ball. It's got that slight bit of sort of artificial coating on it to keep the colour pristine, which maybe just makes a slightly different sound off the bat, but it behaves pretty similarly.
I think it's fair to say, though, that no one quite knows what to expect. I mean, we were speaking to Paul Farbrace, and he was saying, yeah, that, you know, we don't really know what to expect pitch-wise, ball-wise, even the hours, you know, your body clock, playing a day-night test match, all very well playing a one-day international, one-off one-day international day-night, but to play 4 or 5 days of test cricket back-to-back, no one really quite knows what it's going to be like.
And I think that certainly what he was saying, and also what I've heard people say from Australia when being at a day-night test, is that it's very tiring because you still work a normal sort of day, hours-wise, and then you're still playing into the evening. So what Paul Farbrace was saying was that he's expecting players to still be knocking on his door or texting him in the morning saying, I'd like a few throwdowns at 11 o'clock. That's 3 hours before the start of play. Well, normally they will come in at 9 and have throwdowns for an hour before the start of play, being an 11 o'clock start. So, you know, the normal practice is an hour's throwdowns, 9 till 10, then warm-ups, so 10:15 till 10:45, and then the match starts. Well, now you can see players coming in a bit earlier for a bit more practice, and you know, it's still sort of 3 or 4 hours to go till the start of play, and then they've got a whole day's play, and then of course you finish at 9:30 and you're having a warm down and maybe a sort of relaxing drink afterwards. You might not get back to the hotel till 10:30, 11. You know, do you have something to eat then, or you're probably stuffed, so you don't, but you're still sort of living the game a bit, so it's quite hard to relax properly and go to bed at a normal time. So you're ending up probably going to bed at 1 and then getting up the normal time again the following day, more throwdowns. You know, you're ending up with potentially, and this is what Paul Farbrace is slightly concerned about, is you're going to end up with a lot of very tired players.
But I mean, it's an exciting development, and as you mentioned, that the crowds are coming as well. It's sort of, it's piqued the interest of cricket watchers around the country, or be focusing on it. There will be a special focus. But you've been to see the man whose job it is to sort of make the balls and make sure they work.
Well, I've always been interested in the whole sort of manufacture of cricket balls, because bowlers are very fussy about balls. You know, they go and pick them out of the box, and they like the sort of dark ones and the small ones and ones with a proud seam and all that. Of course, they're all virtually identical, but you convince yourself that one ball is better than another. And actually, the visit to this factory, which is a very modest sort of warehouse, basically, in Walthamstow, which is where Dukes are now based, it's a company that was founded in the 1700s, actually, in Kent, but has now moved to Walthamstow, and it's owned by Dilip Jajodia, who's been the man behind Duke's balls and other bits of equipment for the last 10 years. And it's clear from watching him at work and his people at work that actually it's a handmade process. So every ball is actually slightly different because there's a lot of different little techniques that go into making that perfect cricket ball. And because Dukes are handmade, whereas the other main ball manufacturer, Kookaburras, are mainly machine-made, there is quite a big difference in the care and the detail and the attention. And, you know, when you said in your lead-up to this about Dukes possibly helping the bowlers fight back in the game, I mean, that, I think, is very much part of Dilip's aim. He was a bowler in club cricket. He likes bowlers to have a good tool in their hand, if you pardon the expression. And obviously with bats growing in size, you know, balls need a way to fight back. And what he's done is he's made sure the seams are very proud and hand-stitched so that they're a little bit, you know, sort of a bit higher than a Kookaburra would be. There's this layer of grease which they apply to a red ball to stop the moisture getting in, which allows bowlers to really get a good polish on the ball. And there's so much care in getting the ball exactly the right shape. They even put it in the casing of some Crimean War shells and sort of press it down to make it the perfect round shape and to sit in your hand really nicely. So there's a lot of care attached to making a cricket ball and one that bowlers can exploit. And what I was interested to find out from Dilip was, you know, how it differs, the process in making the red ball from the pink ball.
The key to it now is the leather, the fact that it's dyed through, and we've applied a pigment on the top, so it's not like you can't grease it. But with the various polishes and things that we've got, we think it's as near as you can get to a red ball, our red ball, as you can, without it being exactly the same.
So the difference between the red ball and the pink ball, essentially, it sounds like obviously the colour, but yeah, also this grease, yeah, which you can't apply to the pink ball.
No.
Why is that?
Because we've put a pigment on the surface to hold that colour. Whereas with the red ball, it essentially starts a very light shade of red, and when you put the grease onto it, which is for waterproofing, it makes that darker. So, you know, the balls we're working
on
there.
So let's have a look over here, yeah, then, at where the greasing is going on. Now, just explain what's happening here.
Yes, well, basically, the ball has to be greased in order to keep the water out. So
this is for a red ball?
This is for a red ball. And so now, the final process, he does it by a manual process of just applying that synthetic grease, by the way. It's just applied on the surface of the ball, and then it's warmed up with the flame.
So he's got what looks like wax,
yes,
actually,
yes,
and he's sort of melting,
yeah,
it, yeah, with the flame,
yeah,
and then wiping it on the ball,
yeah,
and then
rubs it
and
in
then
by
sort
hand,
of hardening it,
yeah,
on
then
the ball,
he rubs,
with the flame.
Yeah, he rubs it in by hand,
yeah,
and that's now gone well and truly. And so you guys, when you're bowling, you know, you're rubbing away. That's what's coming back through the leather to give you the shine.
And that doesn't happen on the pink and
no,
the white balls.
Because the pink, the surface, has got a pigment which has been pushed in. And so that you can't put that in there. It just won't take it. So what we have to do is to try and apply a polish which will replicate that,
yes,
sort of thing. And, of course, my view is that you just leave one side. Don't do anything with it. And keep polishing the other, and eventually you'll get hopefully the same effect.
So the white ball and the pink ball's seam,
yes,
are exactly the same,
yes,
as the red ball.
Yes.
The only difference with the white and the pink compared to the red,
yeah,
is the application of the grease.
That's
and that's
right.
Why the red Dukes ball does tend to swing,
yes,
quite a lot, whereas the white, we haven't seen too much of the white Dukes ball yet, have
well,
we?
Well, they've started. They're using it tomorrow against Scotland. MCC versus,
yes,
Scotland, and they use it against Afghanistan, and I believe some of the counties are going to have a couple of second 11 games. So they've started to look at it, and I'm pleased because I think it might well give the bowlers a bit of a chance, because at the moment the poor old bowlers in the limited over game is getting a bit, you know, under pressure and might become extinct, I think, because the batsmen have got it all their own way, haven't they?
Well, that's Dilip Jadhodia, who's the owner of Dukes Balls. More from him in Test Match Special with you on Friday lunchtime. Lunchtime?
Lunchtime, whatever well, that is.
Lunchtime. It's probably about
tea time.
Tea time, about 4 o'clock anyway, something like that, on Thursday. We're all going to do some adjustment.
We could all get very fat, actually, on this, because we'll have a big breakfast and a big lunch and then another lunch at lunch at 4 o'clock in the match, and then tea at 6:40, and then go home to the hotel and have dinner at 10 o'clock. So we'll be having 8 meals a day.
That's your challenge, Simon, to stay slim. Now the quiz question: to win one of these new Duke's pink balls, the quiz question is this. It's a simple one. Where was the first day-night test played? So where was the first day-night test played? Email your answer to theanalystcomp@gmail.com. That's theanalystcomp, all one word, @gmail.com. I'll say that again, theanalystcomp@gmail.com. Where was the first day-night test played? And we'll pick a winner and let you know, and you'll be the proud owner of one of these new pink balls. Now, in normal circumstances, England against the West Indies, the way the West Indies are playing recently, the way England have been playing recently, you'd expect England to win this series comfortably. The fact that it's a day-night pink ball test match, does that alter things a bit?
Not really. In fact, it's going to be horribly cold for the West Indies because it's going to be about 12 degrees at night. So it's going to be like those days when they turn up to Durham in May and have to try and play with those hand warmers in their pockets, you know.
It's terrible for them, actually, because normally they come, or they've recently been coming out at the start of the summer and it's been cold. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, give them a series at the end of the summer when it's warmer, and then they're into a freezing cold day-night game.
I remember when Durham had their overseas player, it was a guy called Anderson Cummings, who was a quick bowler, and he was pretty good. But he was so cold in May in Durham that he actually couldn't feel the ball in his hand at all. And we had to sort of basically get him off the field to put his hands on a radiator in between spells to sort of try and warm up so at least he could feel the ball in his hand. Actually, I think the West Indies have got a couple of bowlers that are worth looking out for, one of whom I've seen a little bit of, Alzari Joseph, who played a couple of games against England in the one-day series in March. He comes from Antigua. He's had a bit of help from Curtly Ambrose, and he's got a lovely liquid, fluid action, sort of like a young Michael Holding, not obviously quite as quick, but he's got something, I reckon. And he's only very young. He's only 20. He's hardly played. But I think he'll surprise a few people. They've also got Kemar Roach back, who bowls a heavy ball. So, you know, I see that Shannon Gabriel, who is actually genuinely quick, has had terrible no-ball trouble.
24 no-balls in the match against Derbyshire, 20 in one innings.
That's always a nightmare as a bowler because you can't get any rhythm, you're worrying about your run-up, therefore you're not worrying about where the ball's going down the other end. And it just becomes a nightmare for a bowler and a nightmare for a captain. So if he doesn't sort that out, then he's going to be a licence to print runs. But I like the other two bowlers. I think their batsmen will struggle in these conditions. There's a lot of left-handers, actually. I just think, you know, you imagine Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, they're queuing up to bowl at some of these guys. I know they've made runs against Derbyshire, but day-night test against England's masters of swing and seam is going to be trouble.
When I saw the scores from the match at Derby after about the first couple of days, I thought we're back in the 1970s. West Indies 420 for three declared, and Derbyshire bowled out for 180. But the real test for West Indies is going to come starting on Thursday afternoon at Edgbaston. We should finish off with our Royal London Player of the Week and our low light and highlight. Royal London Player of the Week for you, Simon.
Well, Aaron Finch, a bit of a late call, I suppose. It's been a lot of T20 cricket this week. I've seen a little bit of it up and down the country. Aaron Finch played the best innings, destructive, hit 30 off and over off David Visa, and just looked like a kind of Popeye with a bat. And he scored over 160 balls against Sussex, decimated their attack. So just for that display of power and brutality, I think Aaron Finch has got to have it, Royal London Player of the Week.
There we go. And low light, highlight. I'm going to do the low light this week. And it relates actually to what we were talking about earlier, and the future of test match cricket. And does it need to adapt? Does it need to change because of the problems it's got competing with T20? And I think my low light is Sri Lanka, Sri Lankan cricket. Once so proud, sort of drew themselves up by the bootstraps, World Cup winners, crushed in three successive test matches by India, 304 runs and then two defeats by an innings. And, you know, we've seen the West Indies come over to England. You know, they've got big problems. Sri Lankan cricket seems to have big problems at the moment, and that is not good for world cricket.
No, quite right. I don't know what they do about it. They've just started a first-class competition over there, which Mahela Jayawardene and others say is OK, is decent. They just need, I think, more focus, more investment, a better... The board clearly seem to have had problems. The players and the board together don't seem to get on too well. But in the end, they're a small country who've lost three big players, and they just can't replace them. And I suppose that's kind of understandable, but I hope they find some new ones soon.
Yeah, definitely. Highlight of the week?
Well, I know there's been some brilliant catches, and I know you liked the one by Jack Leeming off Yorkshire, sort of diving back, brilliant catch, one-handed, astonishing catch, actually.
And one by Scott Borthwick as well in the Championship match off his own bowling, and Jimmy Neesham took a brilliant catch in the T20 as well.
Those are definite... sort of second-rate highlights. My highlight of the week, actually, is a slightly strange one, but I was playing in a club game yesterday, first game for 3 years, just playing with a friend of mine, and my son, actually, just to, you know, really play a game of cricket with my son before my knees completely give up. And I just liked this particular incident. We had player umpires, so the umpires, when we were fielding, were from the batting team, and... Sadly, not me, but one of the bowlers bowled a good ball to a batsman who sort of jammed his bat against his pad and was hit on the pad. But it was a bit of a kind of moot point whether he got a bat on it or not. But there was a big appeal for LBW, and the player umpire said to the batsman, "Did you hit that?" And he went, "No." And so the umpire went, "Well, I'll give you out then." And I just thought it was just the honesty of it was absolutely fantastic. When we hear all these stories about cheating and sledging and umpires that won't give anything and player umpires sort of basically giving their team not out for every single incident, I thought this was just a beautiful case of honesty and spirit of cricket.
Absolutely. It might be a unique event, mind you. I can think of plenty of players I played club cricket with who say, yeah, I definitely hit that. No trouble at all.
And, by the way, I walked when I was out.
How many did you get?
Well, naught. and actually, I'm happy I even got a bat on it, really, but it was a big edge. I couldn't really get away with that, so I walked as well.
I think it's time to finish on Yoz's duck. You can subscribe to the Analyst Inside Cricket so you'll get the programme automatically each week. Just click on the button where it says subscribe. Please leave a review of this podcast as well on iTunes. We really would like to know what you think. We'll be back next week when we talk about the first ever day-night test match to be played in England.
Yes, look forward to it.
Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.